Hi there, and welcome to a new episode of my show on Father Roderick, podcasting from the heart of the Netherlands, the beautiful city of Amersfoort, where it's getting colder and colder. Winter is not coming, winter is here. So it's time for a nice, cozy winter show. This episode of my podcast is made possible by my Patreons, or my patrons, I should say, on patreon.com/FatherRoderick. It's a group of listeners like you that are helping me with a small contribution every month. If you want to join them, and by joining them, you get access to a special podcast that I record every week for my patrons, in which I answer questions and I can chat a little bit more. Then check out patreon.com/FatherRoderick. They say it's the season of giving. There are lots of charities that you can support. I'm not saying that I'm not a charity, but in case you have a little bit of spare change, then always great if you can help. If not, feel free to listen for free. That's what I do this for. All right, let's take a look at the news.
You know what's going on? This is what's happening in your world.
They said Catholics rule. We got Boston, South America, the good part of Ireland, and we're making serious inroads in Mozambique, baby.
Taken your first step into a larger world.
2018 is almost a wrap. I've been working really, really hard, and as proven by the lack of regular podcasts lately, since I came back from my pilgrimage to the Holy Land, I've worked three, four days. Non-stop, very, very long hours to get that ready for television. It aired this past Tuesday. Not too shabby in terms of ratings. I think we had like 83,000 viewers on live television, which is really pretty good. And then we get another 10,000 with people that watch the show on the internet afterwards. So that means that with that particular episode, I've reached 100,000 people. That is really exciting. Also, a lot of reactions, of course, as you can imagine, from the pilgrims that went with me to the Holy Land and then were able to relive their journey thanks to the TV episode that I made. I will be making a longer version for an event early next year, so I'm looking forward to revisiting the footage and do a little bit more. But all that has taken its toll, so it was really hard work. But the good news is I'm done for this year when it comes to television. So yesterday we finished the last two Christmas episodes that are being edited, or the final editing's taking place today, and that's it for this year. So I have another about a bit more than a week to get ready for Christmas, to put things in place for the new year, also for our Tridio plans, for the new channel that I'm going to launch next year in the Netherlands and in Belgium, and to get the house ready. And one of the cool things that I was able to do, because I had finished my television work, was yesterday, for the first time in, I really think, decades, I don't recall when was the last time that I had a Christmas tree. Now, normally I don't really care that much for Christmas decorations. I'm more the kind of guy who is like, well, just give me some snow on my screensaver and that's good enough, you know, because I live on screens normally. But of course, as you know, this year, a situation has changed. I've moved to a new rectory and I'm gradually trying to create some atmosphere in the house. And so yesterday, a friend of mine brought me a secondhand artificial Christmas tree. Now, I'm not that much in favor of plastic trees, but in this case, it had belonged to his aunt who had died a while ago. The tree is more than 10 years old. So according to what I've read on the web, it is climate neutral. Saving so many real trees and plus the transport, etc., for those trees, that I can use it without damaging the environment any further. Plus, I mean, it's really good quality. It's a German tree, so it looks very, very sturdy. Sorry for the cliche. but I think if I take good care of it, it can last for another 10 years. Put some lights in the tree, and that's it. I don't have any Christmas decorations. And I don't know what happened between the last time that I put up a Christmas tree and today, but I can't seem to find the kind of Christmas decorations of the olden days. You know, we put these, bands around the tree, with some glitter. I don't even know the words. But anyway, all that is no longer available in the stores. The only thing I saw were these either wooden ornaments, or they would have the Christmas balls or whatever you call them. But I don't like those. I never liked Christmas balls in my trees. I want something else. So now I probably don't have that much time to do anything. And I frankly, already to have a tree and to have some lights in the tree, for me, that's such an upgrade that I don't really care about anything else. I'm perfectly happy with this. But maybe I'll make something myself, or I'll put something geeky in the tree. I don't know. It's not that important. And then we put in place a lot of lamps and LED LED spotlights, etc. And of course, I completely messed up. Went to IKEA and I was like, okay, I need strong lamps. And then we mounted the lamps and you switch on the light and it's blinding. It's so much light. Because I thought, you know, nowadays with LED, they don't tell you the wattage anymore, because of course that's very low with LED. So my only point of reference from you know, how strong is a lamp is from the olden days, when you would say, well, 60 watt, that lights up an entire room. But how many lumen is that? Because nowadays they put lumen in place. So it said 600 lumen for one LED spot. I was like, that sounds okay. That sounds like it's pretty strong. So, but what I didn't calculate is if you have an armature that has five spots and you put five times 600 lumens, that's 3,000. That is a ton of, that's way too much. And so, of course, I put everything in place already. And now the ceilings in my new rectory are super tall. It's like 3 meters. So I can't even reach them, not even with a ladder, at least not with a regular one. So now I can't change the lamps, and it's a little blinding. It's blinding. The light is blinding. So I need to work on that for another week. I made really good progress, and I'm super excited about that with my themed rooms. You remember, since I have such a big house now, I have too many rooms. I'm trying to decorate the rooms not with furniture, because who needs furniture in all those rooms? But I'm trying to do something more creative, and so I made a Bilbo Baggins / Hobbit room, and I created a little corner that evokes the writing corner of Bilbo and Frodo. And of course, I don't have the type of furniture that you see in the Shire, but in terms of, you know, the type of the look, the colors that I use, it does evoke that Hobbit feeling, and it's my writing room. I'm using that in the morning. I try to wake up early. Doesn't always work, especially when you're doing so much editing. But my aim in 2019 is to wake up a little bit earlier than this year and start writing again, and perhaps also drawing and painting. I've got a lot of plans for 2019. And I'm going to sit in that little corner and do exactly that. Then I also have some stuff, some gadgets that I bought. Like last weekend, I went to the Winter Fair. It's the Archeon Winter Fair. Archeon is an open-air museum in the Netherlands where you can actually visit settlements that they recreated that reflect various time periods in the history of my country. So they will have a Roman, what's the name again? That's a bathhouse, a Roman bathhouse. They have settlements from, let's say, the first few centuries, and then they go all the way to the Middle Ages. They recreated a small part of a village that looks like a village in the Netherlands from the Middle Ages. Has a lot of atmosphere already as a museum, but then once a year they have this winter fair, so you have storytelling and theater and people on horses and knights and people dress up. And I went there on Saturday and on Sunday after Mass, and just had a great time just walking around, chatting with people. The more I visit these fairs, the more I get to know people, because you always have the same people that return to those events. And so I got to know a bunch of new people again. One guy is a really interesting guy. He has a Scottish store, like an online store, but he also goes to all these conventions. And so he showed me all his wares and told me how he got started. And he used to work in a totally different business and then got fascinated by the Scottish culture and was like, well, why don't I start a web store? But someone who's really passionate about his enterprise. And I love it when people tell me their story and there's like, oh, first I had this boring job and now I do what I love and I make money with that and I get to visit all these fairs and get to know so many people. I travel. And he sold me one thing, because normally I'm Dutch, so I don't buy it that much. But I was looking for little things to put in my themed rooms. And not only do I have a Hobbit room, but I also have a Harry Potter themed room or a Wizarding World type of room. So I ordered my first wand for cosplay, and it's the wand of Newt Scamander. So it's from the latest movie. And I was like, yeah, Newt, kind of. There are a lot of things that I have in common with Newt. He's not the aggressive type. He loves creatures, animals. He's very much is always exploring. He doesn't want to be judgmental. And so there's a lot of things that I like about his character. And so I ordered his wand. It came in the mail last week. It was surprisingly good quality. I ordered it in China because the wands, if you get the like the official Warner Brothers wands, they're like insanely expensive. This one is kind of a knockoff, but it was very cheap, so I didn't expect much. I thought it was going to be this light plastic thing. Instead, it's this, wow, it feels like you could do some serious magic with that wand. So I have that one. And then I was like, okay, I have the Newt Scamander wand. Now I actually need magical creatures. So during the winter fair, I bought myself a little dragon. And it is adorable. It's a sleeping red dragon. It looks like a tiny little baby dragon, but it's not cutesy or anything. It looks like a real dragon. It's made in this, I don't know what kind of epoxy. So it looks pretty realistic. A little bit of his tail broke off, so I'm still looking to fix that. But we're going to put that on the, what is it, on not in the windowsill, but on the fireplace. So it will look like it's sleeping there. And, you know, it's a little bit what Hagrid does as well. You know, you have these eggs and then dragons come out of these eggs. So I've got a little sleeping dragon. And from the Scottish guy, I bought myself, and this was hilarious, a haggis, a wild haggis. Now, you may think, what is a wild haggis? I know haggis from the stories about, you know, the food, the haggis that you can eat. And so I saw these it's like a toy. It looks like a toy, but it's extremely cute. It's just basically a fluffy ball. Think the Tribbles. It's a Tribble, but it has eyes, nice little dog eyes and a small nose. And it's got a tiny little tail and two ears, like cat-like ears. So it's like a mix of everything that's cute. But I've never seen a little creature like that or a toy like that. So I was like, what is that? That is so cool. He says, it's a wild haggis. And he says, well, you know what? You know about haggis, you know what it's made of, right? It's made of stomach, and people associate it with something that is kind of gross. Now, I've eaten haggis when I was in Scotland twice, and first time it was kind of not very tasty. The second time it was really, really good. If it's spicy, haggis can be really good. But people kind of are, I don't like the idea of eating something that is made out of parts that normally you would throw in the trash. And so, according to my Scottish store owner, he said they wanted to give haggis a better reputation. And so they came up with this story that there was this wild haggis, extremely rare. It's kind of like a cross between a rabbit and a squirrel. And you can only find it in Scotland. And there are people dedicated to hunting the tiny animal. And then that is what haggis is made of. I don't know if that helps, by the way. It's like trying to sell rabbit to kids that love rabbits. It's like, well, but it's rabbit, you know, cute. But why do you eat it? So, but anyway, there's this mythology around the wild. Just Google it for wild haggis and look for it. There's some YouTube videos that are hilarious. And so this toy maker just created a toy version that is even cuter than the original wild haggis that they show in those YouTube videos. And I also bought myself a tiny little box that looks a bit like a suitcase. It looks very much like it could come from a Harry Potter movie. And I put the Haggis in the box. And I'll post a photo. Perhaps the cover art of the episode will be my wild Haggis. And now every morning when I go to work, it looks at me and I have to feed it because otherwise, of course, it gets even wilder. And it's my first magical creature and I couldn't be more excited. So it's a lot of fun. I've got many more ideas, like do-it-yourself ideas to create something that looks and feels like a Harry Potter room. And I'll post some photos over the course of the Christmas weeks. But I'm taking some time off. Also, first in the past decades, I'm going to take off 2 weeks from Christmas, first day of Christmas, until the first week of January. And I really think I'm going to enjoy that time off to recuperate, to recharge my creative batteries, but also to work on those fun projects that normally are only in my mind as like, wouldn't it be cool to have a Hobbit room, to have a Harry Potter room? Well, now in my new rectory, I have the opportunity to create something, to make something. And last, was it yesterday? I bought myself some painting material. So some paint, some brushes, some, what is it, these white things that prefab on which you can paint. Because one of my projects is to start painting and start drawing again. I used to do that a lot when I was in primary school, in high school. I still love doing that, but I never gave myself the time. And I told myself, you know what, I'm doing digital stuff and I'm creating videos and that's kind of the same. It's the digital equivalent. Well, it's not the same. And I want to go back to physical painting. And I have some fun projects that I'm going to make. And I want to learn. I want to teach myself, thanks to YouTube, to become a better painter in a certain way. It's just fun projects. Nothing, I mean, I'm not going to do landscapes or anything. It's going to be geeky painting. But I have some ideas. I have some projects. And of course, if you follow me on Facebook or on Instagram, you'll probably see them appear in your timeline. And with that, I think it is time for our first topic. We're going to talk about movies and TV shows. I recently reduced my movie subscription from a 3D subscription to a 2D subscription because I did the calculations and I just didn't make my money back. They upped the price twice this year because of taxes. Taxes are getting higher. And so I reduced it to 2D movies. I don't care that much for 3D anyway. So that's probably going to give me some new movies to watch.
Not like movies.
They're predictable. Like, the guy gets the girl and that kid sees dead people and Darth Vader is Luke's father.
Not liking movies is like not liking puppies.
They're fine. I just get bored and never make it to the end.
You know, you need a movie education. You need a moviecation. I'm going to give it to you.
I've got some more movies on my to watch list before the end of the year. I want to go see the Bohemian Rhapsody Queen biopic, although I don't think it's that much close. It's not historic, but it's a good story. I hear that from many people. I want to see the movie with Lady Gaga, A Star Is Born. It's a remake of an original movie, and also that is, everybody tells me it's really, really great. I want to go see the new Peter Jackson movie. I didn't even know that it had come out. It's like Machines or something, or what is it, Moving Machines, or I don't know. I don't even know. I totally passed under the radar. I saw John Domick reviewing it. He wasn't too positive about it. He said it's kind of really meh, a 7 out of 10. But it's Peter Jackson, and it's Weta Studio, so the special effects are going to be great. So I want to watch that one. Ralph Breaks the Internet. I'm such a massive fan of the original Ralph Breaks the Internet. That's the second movie, and then Wrecking Ralph? Whatever. The first one, I loved it because of all the geeky, you know, nerdy 80s references to video games that I played when I was a kid. The second one also, according to many people, is one of the best animated movies of the year. So I'm looking forward to that as well. And that's about it. No Star Wars this year. What's that, Disney? It's a Christmas without Star Wars. Now, really, seriously, that is such a painful situation. If only they had saved Solo for Christmas, it would have been such a massive success. But no, they wanted to do it in May. Well, that's what you get for not giving us a Star Wars Christmas movie. So it's going to be another year before we see the conclusion of the current trilogy. I hope that we get at least a trailer before Christmas. Can I ask for that, please? Pretty please? A trailer? If not, it's going to be a Star Wars, a Christmas devoid of Star Wars. There's something really wrong about that. Now, another very disappointing thing that I learned this week is that in the Netherlands, we won't get the new Disney Player, Disney Plus channel anytime soon. This will first launch in the United States, in North America. We won't be able to get it in Europe for another year or so. So it means the Mandalorian, that get all this cool news about Star Wars and these two series that are, so there's going to be the Rogue One-based series and there's going to be the Mandalorian, then you've got the Return of the Clone Wars, all that will be on Disney Plus, and we get nothing in Europe. Come on, Disney. You've got a Disneyland, a Disney World in Paris. Can't you give us a digital channel? What? I really don't know why in this day and age, in 2018, we still need to have these delays in these digital services. And you know what's going to happen? If the moment Disney launches The Mandalorian and the Disney Channel, the people are going to get illegal copies. They're going to get – because everybody wants to see that. So why, Disney? Why can't you – you had like more than a year to get ready for this. And you're not the first to launch a digital channel. I don't know. Hopefully, the only hope that I have is that in the meantime, when Disney Plus is not available here in Europe yet, that Netflix will be able to buy the rights, at least for another year. I don't know. Lately, Netflix over in Europe has acquired quite a few cool movies, but they too, of course, dread the competition of Disney. Because they will lose Marvel, they'll lose Star Wars. They canceled, as you may have heard in the news, they canceled all the Marvel-based series. Even though those series were pretty popular, at least Daredevil was. I'm not sure about the others. Iron Fist, I didn't even get to see the first series. There's just so much on my to watch list. So anyway, they canceled everything. And I think that is because they don't want to depend too much on Disney's content, or Marvel, of course, is also owned by Disney. So this is a preemptive strike, and they're probably going to invest in their own, you know, original series. And that's all well, but what about Star Wars? And what about Marvel? And what about all those cool series that are going to launch on Disney Plus in the US first? Anyway, there is always something else to watch. My current project, since I haven't had time to go to the movies yet, is to rewatch something that I can watch at home, and that is the Harry Potter series. I'm totally back into Harry Potter, and so I've rewatched the first movie, and I was really surprised by how well that movie holds up. Of course, it's a kids movie in a certain way, it's the first one. But if you look at, especially if you look at the behind the scenes stuff and the interviews with the makers, part of the extras on the Blu-ray, it's unbelievable that how forward thinking they were, and how much, like at one point, I think the producer says, "Wouldn't it be awesome if we could film all the episode, all the books?" I don't think they even knew how many books there were going to be and how many movies. But if we could film everything with the same three actors that now play Ron and Harry and Hermione, because then you would, I mean, that would be a first in the history in cinematic history to see literally kids and the roles they play, the characters they play, grow up over the course of many years. And of course, he says that's probably a pipe dream. That's not going to happen. And we're going to have to recast some of those roles. And well, it turned out they filmed everything with mostly the same actors. There are few people that Dumbledore, of course, the actor was replaced. But for the most of the actors, they had recurring roles, and it still holds up really, really well. And I still love that first movie. And I was also shocked to see how much happens in that first movie. It's jam-packed with mystery, with things you discover. And that is probably why the newer movies, like the Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, The Crimes of Grindelwald, are less of a success, because there is the world building has already taken place. And so it feels like, I mean, it has to rely much more on the story itself and on the characters, because you don't have that discovery and that surprise that those first Harry Potter movies gave you. And they continue that. It's not just the first movie. In the second movie, you get to know the parents of Ron, and you get to see the Chamber of Secrets. You get to see more of Hogwarts Castle. And so every time the things that you'd already read about in the books, they would show you for the first time what it looked like. And it was that kind of like curiosity that they could tap into. And they can't with the Fantastic Beasts series, because there are no books. And a lot of the world has been established already. Anyway, I still take it for what it is. I love that magical world that J.K. Rowling created. I love what she's doing in terms of, you know, prequel storytelling. I think it's good. It's not as good as the Harry Potter series, but it grows on me more and more, and I can't wait to see the next movie. So that will keep me busy for the next couple of weeks. Now, of course, at the end of the year, I'll pre-record some shows for when I'm on vacation, and what I usually do is to go over some Christmas movies. Now, I've done that several years, so that's not going to be too interesting, but what I would like to get from you are some suggestions of what you consider to be typical Christmas movies, with either something that you always watch at Christmas or that has a Christmas message. But I want suggestions for movies that have nothing to do with Christmas. So I want Christmas movies that are not about Christmas. Otherwise, you get all the, you know, Christmas Miracle on what is it? Christmas Miracle on Elm Street. No, that's that's something else. But I don't care that much about movies about the Grinch and Santa and all that. I mean, I'll watch them from time to time, or It's a Wonderful World. We've gone over those movies multiple years. But I would like to have your favorite Christmas movie that has nothing to do with Christmas, but somehow is a Christmas movie, in your opinion. So let me know on Facebook, on the website, via Twitter, via Instagram, what is your favorite Christmas movie that has nothing to do with Christmas? And then I'll talk about that in the upcoming shows. And with that, it is time for a visit to the Peculiar Bunch.
Catholics rock!
Here on the Peculiar Bunch, we talk about everything that has to do with Catholics and their traditions and their churches and their customs, but you don't know about them.
Catholics can be a peculiar bunch. No meat on Friday.
No meat? What do they eat, light bulbs?
And one of those peculiar aspects of the Peculiar Bunch is that we will wear rose-colored vestments twice a year.
Man, you guys got more crazy rules than Blockbuster Video.
And this upcoming Sunday is one of those 2 days in the year that the liturgical color switches to rose. Now, I've explained in the past that it has to do with, you know, normally the color for these preparation weeks, whether it be it Lent or Advent, is purple. And in like halfway through that time, there will be a more joyful Sunday, where you're past the halfway point, so you're actually getting closer to the big feast that you're celebrating. So it kind of lightens the color. It's no longer purple, but it becomes rose. So to indicate visually that, you know, this is kind of a more lighthearted Sunday in this time of preparation. Well, that is the case for this third Sunday of Advent. It's called Gaudete Sunday. Of course, I've explained in the past, it has to do with the Introitus, the opening song in Latin. For that particular mass, which starts with the word Gaudete, rejoice. The official word is rejoice. The song in Gregorian chant is Gaudete in Domino Semper. So always rejoice in the Lord. Iterum dico, I will say it again, Gaudete, be glad. And so that first word becomes the name of the Sunday. Now, that is a good occasion to talk a little bit about, well, what is joy? Actually, it's something I always took for granted, joy. Well, Catholics are joyful people, but is joy the same as happiness? Is it the same as being always, laughing and smiling and life is rose-colored? And is that joy, or is there something more to the concept of joy? Well, the opening song in itself seems to be a bit problematic. It's rejoice in the Lord always. How can you always be joyful? How can I be joyful before I had my first coffee in the morning? Is that even possible? Well, that's where you start to discover that joy is something else than being cheerful, for instance, or being happy. The thing is, you can be unhappy, but still be joyful. And I found a very good explanation of the difference in the writings of a Dutch theologian and fellow priest. He's deceased, but I met him when he was still alive. Very well known in the United States, North America, also known in the Netherlands, but not as popular. It's Henry Nouwen. He's a priest of my diocese and lived in the United States for the latter part of his life in a community with people with a disability. And other people, and he wrote a ton of books, and those books are really, really beautiful. When he describes the difference between joy and happiness, he says happiness is often dependent on external conditions. When are you happy? It's when on the day of your wedding, on the day of your ordination, and so it requires stuff to happen around you. When are you happy? When you're not stressed, when people are not being mean to you, when you don't struggle with unemployment or a setback in your life or people hurting you or wounds from the past. There can be so many reasons that make us unhappy. So happiness does depend on all those external conditions, and you can't always control those. You can't always get rid of all the stress in your life. You can't get rid of suffering in your life. And so someone who suffers probably won't say, well, today's a happy day. I just lost my leg and I'll be operated and I just heard that I only have 2 weeks to live, but I'm happy. No, that's not a happy time. But you can't be joyful in the middle of unhappiness. And joy, according to Henry Nouwen, is best defined as the experience of knowing that you are unconditionally loved and that nothing, even sickness or failure or emotional distress or oppression or war or even death, none of those things can take that love away, that love that loves you unconditionally. And I thought it was a beautiful, very concise description of what joy truly is based upon. It's the joy. Why do we speak of the joy in the heavens, the angels that are singing joyfully at Christmas night? We think because, well, it's beautiful and it's snowing and it's romantic and, you know, we have those nice songs and little baby Jesus is just lying there in this cute cradle, cute crib, and St. Joseph is making a little bit warm porridge for poor little Jesus, and that's why it's so joyful. No, it was a very hard time for Joseph and Mary. They were very far away. Now that I've been to the Holy Land, you start to realize what a distance it was to go from Nazareth, where Mary lived, all the way to Bethlehem. That is a very harsh, tough journey. It was in the winter time. And that's a time when the weather it's not warm there. It can be very cold at night. And so not to mention the persecution and the threat that was present. And then Jesus being born in the middle of nowhere. far away from home, those were not happy days for Joseph and Mary. And yet, the story tells us that the angels were singing of joy, joy to the world. Well, what is that joy? It's not based on, you know, this happy Christmas feeling, but it was based on the fact that God had sent his Messiah to love us unconditionally. In the birth of that child, God's love became flesh. And if you look at the life of Jesus, what he does is to love unconditionally. He makes no difference between people that are rich or poor, between sinners and saints, between people that are Jewish or people that are have nothing to do with the Jewish faith. He loves even his executioners, the people that put him on the cross. That is unconditional love. I love you even though you hate me, even though you hurt me, even though you try to kill me, I still love you. I forgive you on the cross. That's unconditional love. Father, forgive them because they don't know what they do. That is love, to forgive a criminal that's crucified for the right reasons, you know, because it was, I don't know, a murderer or whatever. And it's this constant message of Jesus that, and he says, who sees me sees the Father. So his actions toward the people around him are what God is, the way that God treats us. And so if Jesus loves everyone unconditionally, it means God loves us unconditionally. That is the joy that the angels sing about. And that is a joy that we celebrate on this Sunday Gaudete, on this. It's the reminder that we are being loved, that we have been loved 2,000 years ago when Jesus came and loved the people around him unconditionally, showing the unconditional love of the Father. But that's still present. That is still the case. He loves me and he loves you also without conditions. No matter what you've done in your life, no matter how much you messed up everything, how much you consider yourself to be a failure or other people consider you to be a failure, for God it doesn't matter. He doesn't care. It doesn't count. He loves you with all his heart because that's what he does. That's what God does. And it's also something in the future, because the what we celebrate at Advent is not just the fact that Jesus came to us. Advenire in Latin means to come closer. It's not just that what happened 2,000 years ago. It's also what happens in every Mass we celebrate. Jesus comes to us. He loves us. He gives us his body and blood unconditionally. And he tells us that he will come again. And so it's also this future return of Jesus at the end of our history, at the end of times, when he will come to wrap things up and to in a definitive way, rid this world from suffering, from pain, from hatred, and anything else that stands between us and his love, his unconditional love. That is the joy that is already being announced in this Advent time, and it propulses us to this future, and it tells us, you know, whatever is currently the situation, how no matter how unhappy you feel and how much your life is in ruins perhaps, or I don't know how much struggle you currently have, you can still rejoice always because God loves you in your pain, in the deepest night that you have to go through, in your deepest depression. One thing is certain. God loves you regardless of what is happening, regardless of what you are doing or not doing. He loves you because that's what God does. And we know this because Jesus told us that that was the case. So that is the meaning of Sunday Gaudete. I hope it helps you to experience it perhaps in an even deeper way. Time for books.
When did you become an expert in thermonuclear astrophysics?
Last night. The packet. The extraction theory papers. Am I the only one who did the reading?
I so love my reading chair. I got myself this this nice old-fashioned faux leather chair that is near my faux chimney, my fake chimney that has no fireplace. I'm working on it. But it is still this nice coat. And not only did I get a chair, but I also got myself a sheep. Well, not a sheep, but a sheep's skin. And it's really, really warm and nice and cozy. I have a little blanket, a red, nice blanket that I picked up. All this is bought in the, It was not the secondhand corner, but every IKEA has a corner where they put stuff that's, for instance, demo models. It's fully assembled furniture, but it's been used either in the store or it has been returned or it has a minor defect. And so they will discount it heavily, usually, you know, 30, 40% off. So I got myself that chair there. I got myself a little blanket that's really nice because my house tends to be cold from time to time. There's something, you know, we're still working on the heating system to regulate that. So, I love sitting there and reading on my Kindle. And so I'm still watching every time. If you follow me on Facebook, you know, it gets often annoying how many tips I post of books that are on sale in the Kindle store. So I picked up recently Star Wars From a Certain Point of View. This is a book that I wanted to read for a long time. It consists of 40 stories. It's like 470 pages or something like that. So it's a thick, it's a big book. 40 authors, 40 stories, all based on the existing movie. So I think it's 4, 5, and 6. Or perhaps even just A New Hope. I don't know. And it gives a twist to many of the scenes that we know and love. So it will, for instance, tell the story of a stormtrooper that's looking for those droids. And you get a little bit of backstory. You get stories from the cantina, from things that were happening, you know, that may have happened, but they're not part of the movie. But so it fills in a lot of the backstory of that first movie. It's 40 authors. And some really great ones. Will Wheaton, the Star Trek guy, he wrote a story for this. It's also, I heard the audiobook is pretty good, but I didn't pick it up because it was just a regular price. It wasn't discounted. But anyway, it's fun. Plus, I saw that it's probably still on sale in this month, so check it out. The proceeds go to charity. I think it's a charity, an American charity that gives funds to children that have no money to read. They can't buy books. And so when you buy this book, it will help children to read. I think that's a worthwhile charity. So pick that one up. Looking forward to reading. And I love books like that with short stories because, you can just read one very quickly and go to bed and just in between the other stuff that I'm reading. I also picked up, there was a Tolkien sale. So one day, about a week ago, I think I posted it also on Facebook. A ton of Tolkien books went on sale. The usual ones, you know, The Hobbit, the Lord of the Rings, but also The Silmarillion. And I picked up the audiobook of The Silmarillion as well. And The Fall of Gondolin was the first time, this is the last book that Christopher Tolkien compiled based on the writings of his father. And it chronicles the fall of Gondolin. It's this old city. I think this even takes place in the part of Middle-earth that is no longer there when Bilbo and Frodo are around. It's one of those, it's kind of the last book that we will probably get, because I don't think that Christopher Tolkien has a successor when it comes to this meticulous work of restoring, kind of assembling all the notes of his father and then turning them into finished stories that you can actually read. So I don't know. Of course, you never know with Tolkien. There may be other ways in which the Tolkien estate is going to expand upon the legacy of Tolkien himself. But for Christopher, this is the last book. And it hadn't been on sale yet. Now I could pick it up for $2.99. I also picked up Unfinished Tales. I was like, I don't have it. It's Tolkien. I'll buy it. Those three books I didn't have already. So now I have, I think, most of the books that are available on Kindle. There are many more books, but this will probably keep me busy for a while. Also, of course, motivated to read more Tolkien because of the television series that is currently in development by Amazon Prime. And I heard that at first, Peter Jackson was not involved. And he said, yeah, they didn't contact me. Well, turns out they did in the meantime. It doesn't mean that he's going to helm the project, not at all. But they asked him for advice. And so he's going to be reading the scripts that they're developing. And that, to me, is a huge reassurance. I was like, Peter Jackson, of course, has made mistakes, and there's no film version of Tolkien's work is perfect. But I thought that he did, given the circumstances and the constraints, you know, that Warner forced him to turn The Hobbit into three movies. Despite all that, I think he did a pretty good job. And so, he knows how to tell these stories. And so I love it that he's going to read through those scripts and give them advice on what to do and what not to do. I can't wait. But in the meantime, since we're still waiting for that television series, I'll just read the originals. And then I bought another book, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. This may surprise you that I'm actually a skeptic, because people think, well, you're a priest, so you believe anything. Well, no. The Catholic Church is very rational in a certain way. We love science. it's a lot of the great scientists in the history of mankind were priests, were theologians, were people from the Catholic Church. So there has never been this science denial in the Catholic tradition. It also means that I have a skeptical. What is a skeptical attitude? It means that you always verify what you read. You don't believe it just because, well, it feels good. You know, even in theology, that is based on a revelation, so it's not based on verifiable facts per se, but it is, in its method, a very scientific discipline. You can't just write anything, well, I think that God is this and that and that. No, a theologian works according to the academic standards, even though it's based on revealed truths. And so it's take it or leave it. Philosopher will get to a certain point, so based on a reason. And even in theology, you will find that same approach. It's like there are a lot of aspects of the Catholic faith that are not based on the Bible. It's based on just sound philosophy, and we embrace that. But there is more to that. But anyway, what I can't stand is all the superstition stuff. The stories, and you read them, and it's like a lot of the nowadays is so called, you know, scientific channels are like. Think of Discovery Channel. How much humbug have we seen over the years with these so-called paranormal investigations and all the hyped up nonsense that they try to sell you as science, and it's not. It's just trying to get eyeballs and hyping up stuff that. And so I listen to a lot of those skeptic podcasts as well that debunk so much of that superstition. And of course, I don't mind them being critical towards the Catholic beliefs as well. There are a lot of superstitions flying around in the Catholic and the Christian hemisphere, and I don't mind at all people, you know, looking with a critical eye to that, because that's what I do too as a theologian. You got to stay critical. Don't believe things just because, well, someone nice tells these things. And so I'm much more skeptical than you would believe, even towards things like apparitions and so-called miracles. And like, I'm totally willing to be open to things that science can't explain. But if science can't explain them, I'm not going to reject that and say, well, though it's a miracle. Those two should keep each other in balance. And I think that science can only go to a certain level. There are metaphysical things that pertain to the realm of metaphysics. So they cannot a physicist or an astronomer can't say anything about the existence of God, because it's beyond the realm of what is measurable and knowable. It also means that the church and the theologian can't say anything that invalidates science. So those, you know, deniers of evolution and the people that take the Bible as a literal account of how things happened and thereby reject a lot of the scientific findings, that is not a Catholic attitude at all. So the thing is, when I read a book, a skeptical book, or I listen to a skeptical podcast, and they do attack certain Catholic things, I'm fine with that. I even welcome it, but I want them to do their homework. I don't want them to judge the Catholic Church on the basis of hearsay or incorrect information. And I took a look at that book. It was on sale, and I was like, okay, it's a big book, and I kind of was always, I always like reading about that. It helps me think according to, you know, the scientific principles as well. And I found one chapter that was about exorcism. And it in the title, it already went wrong. It's like, medieval beliefs will yield medieval results. I was like, as soon as people start using medieval in a pejorative term, I'm thinking, that is not scientific. And any historian would attack you on that, because the Middle Ages were anything but primitive. That is the Dark Ages. The Dark Ages don't exist. No historian will ever talk about the Dark Ages. And if he does, it's not an historian. It's a crook. The Middle Ages were great times of scientific discovery, of an incredible diverse culture. The Middle Ages were one of the richest times in our history. And it is actually superstition in a certain way, historical superstition, to say, well, the Dark Ages. And thank goodness for the Renaissance. That's when people woke up from their, you know, thousand-year slumber and started to think for themselves again. It is a cliche, and it's historically incorrect, and it's unscientific. Well, so when I read that in the title, medieval beliefs, medieval results, and it's about exorcisms, I'm thinking, uh-oh, that's someone who didn't do the homework. Well, the rest of the chapter exactly proved my point. So it's all anecdotal stuff. They say, well, in the church, even though we already know that all this is, of course, psychiatrical disorders, etc., but the Catholics still believe that any priest can do exorcisms, and then they do, and then they start describing something that kind of sounds like The Exorcist, and they say, well, I've watched countless videos of exorcisms, and either nothing happens, or it's like a bad reenactment of the Exorcist movie. I'm thinking, okay, so you're basing your judgment of what exorcism is on videos that you watched? And then they say, every priest has to do these exorcisms. Uh-uh, that's not true. At least not in the Catholic Church. Priests are, there are, exorcism, what is an exorcism? An exorcism is a prayer. It's a prayer. It's not a magic trick, but a prayer that chases away evil spirits. An evil spirit, as such, is not a psychological thing. It is not something that, from a scientific point of view or measurable point of view, you can say anything about. It is a theological concept. We read about evil spirits and about the devil in the Bible. Jesus talks about them. And in Catholic theology, if you read Thomas Aquinas, they are pure spirits. We call them angels as well. Demons, bad, evil spirits, are nothing else than angels, pure spirits. And there's a lot you can say about just what is a pure spirit. We are a combination of mind, of spirit and body. So we are both material and spiritual beings. The both are conjoined and can't be without the other. One is the form, the other is the matter, if you want to go into deep Thomism. But anyway, you can also think, at least in your mind, theologically, even from a philosophical point of view. So if we are both matter and spirit, what would be a pure spirit without matter? What would that entail if you think that through? So our the matter of which we consist, our bodies, we are in time. Pure spirits don't know time. Time is linked to the material world. So it means that any decision that an angel makes is irrevocable, and angels, if God created angels, then they and angels resemble us as well, except for the fact that they don't have a body. They have a free will. That is what makes them. That's why they have a soul. They have free will, so they can choose for good or against the good. And the pure spirits are angels that have made the decision to not accept God's love, to reject God's love, and so you become the opposite. So anyway, from a just a purely theological and philosophical point of view, there's a lot you can say about the concept of a pure spiritual being. But that is beyond the realm of a skeptic. They can say, well, that's all humbug and it's all psychological. That a skeptic, if a skeptic wants to judge on the basis of pure science, you have to also respect the limits of your scientific world and what you can say scientifically. You can say, well, scientifically, we can't prove that angels exist. We can't prove that demons exist. Therefore, from a scientific point of view, we don't take them into account. You can't say that they don't exist. You can just say, well, in the world of science, we cannot, they don't enter the equation. A philosopher probably wouldn't say that. But anyway, the other thing that I really disliked about that chapter is that, so they go against the good reasoning. They take anecdotal evidence, like some videos that I watched. So what is that? And then they say, well, none of it has been ever measured and ever proven and whatnot. And plus, and then they start to go really down the drain in terms of, you know, the quality of the chapter. It hurts people. It damages people. And there are tons of there's a lot of proof that people die during exorcisms and they get physically hurt, et cetera, et cetera. And then that is illustrated also with anecdotes, stuff they've seen on YouTube. It's like, do your homework. If you would talk to, let's say, an exorcist, every diocese has an exorcist, you would discover that actually those people are trained in psychology. It's not about what you see in the movies. There's a lot of discernment that goes on, and a lot of the exorcists that exist are pretty skeptical people that don't very quickly say, well, that's the devil or that's the demon. And even in the exorcisms themselves, they will be very careful, mild. I mean, Catholic faith is about love, not about hurting people and destroying them and causing damage. So anyway, there's much more to say about it, but I'm kind of on my soapbox here. But that's where I think skeptics have to be self-critical as well. I mean, I'm all for verification of the facts and measuring and debunking superstition, but I also want them to be fair and scientific in their approach to religion. And unfortunately, in some of those skeptic circles, there's this underlying atheism that I think thwarts their judgment and makes them kind of almost illogically opposed to anything that has to do with religion, even from a sociological point of view, or as someone who studied sociology, they will take religion very seriously. Why? Because it's a fact of life. Like half the world is religious and has been for since the beginning of mankind. So a sociologist will just study that. So won't judge about the, you know, whether there is a foundation for that faith, but it is a part of life. And sometimes in those skeptical circles, you see that they want to destroy religion because it's in their minds it equates to superstition. And I think that's where they are wrong. And that's why I'm critical and skeptical sometimes towards these skeptics, even though I applaud what they try to do. And I think we need skeptics, but we also need skeptics that know a little bit about theology and about philosophy and do their homework. Do your job. That's all I'm going to say about it.
We are on the cutting edge of technology.
Wow. Well, what does that mean?
Plug it in. It's going to say, hey, I see you plugged in a new device, and it's going to load in the appropriate drivers. You'll notice that this scanner build, whoa.
Well, all your technology stuff, it just ends in disaster.
But there is one more thing.
We talk about technology every podcast, and I have a few tech things that were going on. I finally got my new battery in my iPhone. You know about BatteryGate, when Apple was discovered to to throttle the CPUs of their phones because the battery would degrade, but they didn't tell anyone. And so I've had exactly that problem. You know, a few years ago, I went to walk the Camino and I filmed everything with my phone, with my iPhone. It was like, wow, I can't believe I can do this with my iPhone. It's television quality. And then I wanted to continue that. So I got myself a gimbal and I was like, oh, I'm going to vlog more with my iPhone. And then I started to notice that every time I made a recording, it would drop frames or the application would crash. And it wasn't because of the faulty software updates. It was because Apple was slowing down my CPU in order to save the battery from sometimes accidentally completely closing down the phone. But that, because the CPU was degrading or was slowing down, the video application would not function as well anymore and it would drop frames, making basically my phone unusable for filming. I really resented Apple for that. So since that came out, a lot of people threatened to start a class action lawsuits. Apple said, well, we're going to strike you a deal normally to replace the battery of your phone. It would have to have a proven defect if it's still under warranty. And otherwise, we will charge you, what is it, $90 or something like that. It's very expensive to change the phone. Also, because Apple more and more makes sure that you can't repair their equipment yourself. You know, not so long ago, you could just open a compartment on your phone and plug in a new battery. I did that with some of my phones. Nowadays, it's all glue on the inside, and only certified Apple repair centers can replace your battery. That's why it's so expensive. There's also a monopoly going on there. And so Apple said, well, we'll charge you this year only, we'll charge you $29 instead, or 29 euros instead of, what is it, 89. And so by the end of the year, of course, people like me are like, oh, I totally forgot to do that. And next year it's going to be so expensive. I got to get an appointment. And then you start to discover that not only is it difficult, it has to be repaired by an officially, you know, only a few companies and centers can do that. But there is a long line of people waiting to do that. So it's really, really hard to find a place where they can repair that in time before the end of the year. Ultimately, I find this company in Amsterdam, the south of Amsterdam. I drove there, waited for about 20 minutes, and they got the battery fixed, and I got it back. They did charge more than 29. So it turns out that 29 is only if you go to an Apple store. But that Apple store can only replace, I don't know, 10 batteries every day. So I was like, Apple, what are you doing? You're trying. We're paying you for something that actually should be, at least you should have explained it. So I think that Apple should have replaced my battery for free. But anyway, I'll still take the deal. But then they make it so hard for you to find a place to repair your phone. And then if you repair it in any other place, and there are only two Apple stores in the Netherlands, if you go anywhere else, you pay more. So I paid 35. It's still cheap on the cheap end, but they didn't tell me in advance that it would be more expensive than what they advertised. Stuff like that make me less and less enthusiastic about Apple. And there is a chance that my next phone will not be an Apple phone. I'm not sure about the tablets because the Android power tablets are really bad, but my iPad is still functioning quite all right, although it does have these sudden shutdowns now from time to time. But now, the thing is, now that the new battery's in my phone, I see the difference. It's just like it used to be. And I had forgotten how fast my phone was. And so the difference is night and day. And it's just because of that phone battery. I really hope that the industry will go back to replaceable batteries, if only for the environment. It's just this planned obsolescence of these phones. It is just because a lot of people will not be able to get their battery replaced. And then so they'll just throw away the phone. Or trade it in. It was like, yeah, phew, it's so slow. I can't use it anymore. If this phone with the old battery, if it went to battery saving mode, so if you go below 20% of the battery, it would be unusable. It would be so slow that I couldn't type on it anymore. And my battery had only degraded to 80% of its capacity. let alone if it goes to 50%. I mean, the tech industry. Then, in other news, I'm still working on my smart home. I've now connected to my first few, audio Chromecasts. Still getting my house in order. I do want to try out those Chinese smart plugs that I have that you can also control through Google Home Mini. And I'm looking into setting up these routines. So if I wake up, ideally it would put on the lights, start the coffee drip, etc. Play me the latest news. I can tell that Google is still working on this. It's a work in progress, but it's getting better all the time, and I like that. And then finally, I ordered two new devices. I haven't received them yet, so that's the reviews are forthcoming, but I'm super excited about them. The first one is a small 360 VR camera from the Chinese brand Xiaomi. So it's the Xiaomi Yi YI 360 VR camera. It films in 360 degrees in 5.6K, so it's super high resolution. And I couldn't be more excited. I've always wanted to try out 360 storytelling. And I have some ideas what I could do. I remember one video that I tried out. It's like an interactive story on the Oculus Go. And it was these guys that were climbing a mountain. And so every time you would be in an environment and they would, you know, it was a snowy mountain somewhere in the, I think in, what's that park again? What was it called? Yosemite, in Yosemite Park. They're climbing the tallest mountain in Yosemite Park. And you see them arrive, and then they tell you, well, we're currently at a halfway point, and look at nature here, and they explain things. And then they will move along, and then the next scene is they're almost at the top, etc. I thought that kind of storytelling works really well in 3D. What doesn't work is walking around with a 3D camera, or with a VR camera. Because then you'll always see the person holding the camera. Plus, all the moving around doesn't really... It creates motion sickness. So I'm thinking, I'm traveling a lot. I love to walk and to climb mountains and stuff. I'm going to try out some of that storytelling. And maybe I can also apply this by going to cathedrals and to religious, to certain Catholic places and do something like that. Just do what I do with my television show and with, you know, in the olden days with my podcast, bring you along and let you visit places with this camera. And it was like a massive discount. I think this one will only cost me 160 euros. And it's one of the best VR cameras on the market. The competition is like 400, 500 euros. So I'm looking forward to try that out in the next year. The second device that I purchased for Tridio is the DJI Pocket. It is a tiny camera on a tiny gimbal that fits in your trousers. It's really tiny. A massive difference with the gimbals that I've used so far. And we're going to use that as a second camera, as a B-roll camera for the TV shows. So Martin can walk around with that. We can do walking shots. We can do like B-roll that I can use for interviews, etc. And it's so tiny. And the quality, again, is 4K. Unbelievable how rapidly camera technology is evolving and is getting better and more affordable, because that DJI Pocket gives you so much ability for nothing, just a fraction of what you would pay last year. I'm super excited about it. Once I figured out how they work and I've done some experiments with it, I will talk about it on this show as usual. And that brings us to the end of this episode of my show. Thank you so much for hopping by. Hope you enjoyed it. And as usual, take a look at Tridio.com for all our other shows and also for links to how you can support us. Thanks to my patrons for making this possible. Patreon.com/FatherRoderick. I will see you soon. Take care. God bless.